So, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Bhante Sujato, and I'm from Santi Forest Monastery outside of Sydney. And welcome today to Venerable Santuti from Bodhinyana and Venerable Analia, also from Santi Forest Monastery. So, for this afternoon, I'm going to be teaching a little bit of metta meditation, a bit of loving kindness meditation. Now, first of all, can I ask how many here were here last night? Okay, so a few people were here last night. Okay, because we did a bit of guided metta meditation last night as well, but since not everyone was here. So I'll talk about the metta meditation for a few minutes and then we can do some guided meditation together. So metta meditation is one of the very many forms of meditation which the Buddha taught. And I think it's important to remember the fact that the Buddha didn't insist that everybody practice the same kind of meditation. Actually, many different kinds of meditation, because people have many different personalities, many different characters. So there's many different starting points that we can take. And it's not the case that you know, any one meditation is going to be better than the other, but it may be the case that certain meditations are more suitable. Now, in the Buddha's day, if you wanted to know which one was the right kind of meditation for you, you'd go and see the Buddha and you'd ask him and he'd kind of check you out with his psychic powers. And then he'd say, you do this meditation. And then you go, right, that's it. And you go and do that. These days it's a little bit more complicated. And it's interesting that in the Buddhist scriptures that even you even have cases where the Buddha's chief disciple, Sariputta, he even makes mistakes when he's teaching meditation and gives the wrong meditation object. So even Venerable Sariputta doesn't have that facility to be able to know exactly what's the right way of meditating for every one person. So I think that's a good thing to bear in mind for those of us who are trying to teach meditation, to remember that we can only act as guides, we can only lend a helping hand. But actually, if we want to find out what's suitable and what's the best way to meditate for ourselves, we have to know inside here. And that's the only true test. Actually, one time somebody came to ask Ajahn Chah that very question, and they said, do you teach your students by reading their minds and telling them how to meditate? And he said, here at my monastery, I teach people how to read their own minds. Yeah? So can you see the difference? Yeah? Learning how to read your own mind is the important thing. Because, of course, by learning to understand your own mind, this is how you get wisdom. Yeah? You learn to understand. So the best way to, if you want to figure out which meditation is the right one for you, best way is just to try it out. Yeah, and try out some different meditation methods and see how they go. So for this afternoon, we'll try out some loving-kindness meditation. Now, the essence of loving-kindness meditation, the most important thing is that loving kindness is a feeling. It's not words, it's not concepts, it's not an idea. It's the feeling of loving kindness. So the whole structure and technique, it has only one purpose, and that's to help to evoke that feeling, to sustain it, to keep it, and to develop it, and to further it. And using that feeling as a basis, we can bring the mind to a deep state of concentration or samadhi in just the same way as you can use the breath as a method of bringing your mind to concentration or samadhi. So the meditation is about a feeling. Now, some people would say that immediately means that all Aussie males should not even bother trying. but I'm an Aussie male and I've tried it and it works for me, so I know that that's not the case. Everybody has feelings. Everybody has a feeling of metta. We all know what it is, loving kindness, we all know what it is. We've all experienced it. It's an essential part of what forms and creates the human mind. We learnt what metta was, what loving kindness was when we were babies, when we were being held in our mother's arms. We've all had that experience, that very pure sense of love, that pure, absolutely selfless, absolutely unconditional. When we use the word love in Buddhism for metta, what we mean is that a wishing or an aspiration or a just the inspiration for the happiness of oneself or the happiness of others. And the important thing about metta as a feeling or as an emotion is that it's very, very simple. Loving kindness is very simple, very childlike, it's very naive. Loving kindness by itself doesn't understand anything, like the love of a child doesn't understand anything. It's different, for example, from compassion. In compassion, you understand suffering. Yeah? Compassion involves empathizing with the suffering of another, yeah? Having the wish to remove the suffering of another. So compassion is like a richer emotion, it's a more mature emotion. Metta is not that mature, it's more simple, more playful. So when I do the metta retreats, whenever I can, I always have a teddy bear with me to sit the retreat. So if you're sitting meditating and if you're finding it hard to feel the loving kindness, then you just sit and you look at Teddy. Teddy doesn't have any issues. He's always the best meditator on every retreat. He sits there the whole time, perfectly happy. So the meditation cushion and that period of time when we're setting aside for meditation and to develop loving kindness, at that time we don't, you know, we're like that, we're like Teddy, we don't have any issues. This is not the time for working out relationship problems or working out emotional turmoil or any of those kinds of things. There's a time and a place for those things. Metta meditation is not that time, it's not that place. This, I think, this is something that's very, very important to remember. One of the key things about meditation and that period of time we meditate is that meditation puts a set of boundaries, creates a set of boundaries, and it's like a sandbox. Within that sandbox, we can allow ourselves to feel. We can allow ourselves to let down the barriers, you know, let down the obstructions and so on. We can say, okay, this is a safe place. Yeah? Within these boundaries, this is a safe place. Because normally we're kind of a bit scared of these emotions and stuff, aren't we? Yeah? We have to sort of keep them under control. So in meditation, we don't have to. If we start crying, that's okay. If we sit there and start laughing spontaneously, giggling away while we're meditating, don't worry about what other people think about you. It's very normal. Sometimes people will be sitting there crying, tears coming out of their eyes. Don't worry, just let that all come through. Yeah? So it's just like a playground. We're playing with the emotions in a positive way. And at the end of the meditation, we'll come back to normal. So when doing metta meditation, one of the One of the problems, I think, of the way that metta is very is often taught is that often metta is taught in a way that's quite vague. It's like a thought of loving kindness, or you sort of go through the chant of loving kindness and spread metta to different beings in different directions or to your different relatives or something like that. And it's all very nice, and you get kind of nice feeling, and it's positive, but it doesn't go very far. It just stays at that level of having a nice thought and a nice feeling, but doesn't develop any strong concentration. So the method that I'm going to be teaching a little bit of this afternoon, and which I'm teaching more of in the 9-day retreat we're doing next week, this method is specifically designed to help support the development of metta for a stronger concentration and deeper concentration. And one of the keys to that, one of the great secrets to doing metta meditation, is to keep the feeling localized inside your body. Keep the feeling of metta inside your body. There's all these wonderful images in the Pali Suttas about the way that the joy and the bliss of meditation, it says, is like a lotus which grows in a clear forest pool, and the lotus grows underneath the surface of the pool so that the cool water of the pool soaks through every part of that lotus. And in that simile, the lotus is a metaphor for our body as we're sitting in meditation, and the cool water is a simile for the feeling of rapture and joy which soaks through your body. So this is something that we do quite deliberately, quite consciously in the metta meditation, evoking that feeling of loving kindness and soaking it through your whole body. So that's a bit of a skill. It takes a bit of a while to do. Don't expect to do that on the first time that we sit. It's something that takes time. But let's see at least if we can get something of that feeling of metta, something of what that actually is like, and to actually feel that and feel that inside one's own self, outside one's own body. The other crucial part about this method is that it involves developing metta for four people in turn: oneself, a loved person, a neutral person, and a disliked person. So for today, because we only have a short time to sit together, we'll just do metta for oneself and for a loved person. So before we start, I want everybody to think of one loved person, somebody who's dear to you, someone who's easy to develop loving kindness for. Generally speaking, when you're doing the metta for a loved person, it's best to choose somebody who you have a very simple, childlike love for. And often it's best to choose somebody who's perhaps not in your immediate family, because people who we're very close to, we tend to have complicated relationships with. But somebody who's maybe sort of one step distant, like maybe a niece or nephew, for example, or somebody who's like a good friend or something like that, a teacher perhaps. According to the traditions, best not to choose, in the metta meditation itself, best not to choose somebody who's dead to develop metta for. I'm not quite sure why that is. Maybe it's because they're going to like the metta so much they're going to come and join you in the meditation. And if you have ghosts around in the meditation, it tends to be a bit disturbing sometimes. If not for you, maybe for others around. But I think perhaps more to the point is the fact that if you're doing metta for somebody who's passed away, then you're also quite likely to have grief arising. Yeah, so that sense of grief will tend to taint the metta. So So we'll do some guided meditation for the next 45 minutes. We'll start out with doing a period of 5 to 10 minutes of just mindful awareness. And then following that, we'll start doing the metta. And we'll do metta first for oneself and then for a loved person. And so in this short session, we just get to try to get a flavour for the practice and to see what, if any, kind of response we get, and see how we can bring the feeling of metta, evoke the feeling of metta inside. Okay, so let's get ready to sit meditation. Sitting quietly. The mind to settle back into the body. Feeling grounded and centered inside this body. Not worrying about the past, not running off to the future, just paying attention to the feelings and sensations inside this very body, here and now. When a thought comes into the mind, just note it, thinking, thinking, thinking. cutting through the stream of thought, not being interested in the thought, not getting caught up in it. Thinking, 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 and then letting the mind rest in the silence, in the space, in the gap between the thoughts. Noticing inside the body the mood, the emotion that we're carrying through into this meditation. What do I feel like? Is that joy or sadness, jealousy, anxiety, relief, contentment? Whatever that is, just be aware of it. Just know it. Oh, okay. It's like that. And leaving the mind in the heart, you say to oneself the words, May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Saying the words evenly, steadily. Continue reminding oneself of the meaning of those words. Reminding oneself of that deep wish that we all have for true happiness. True well-being. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. as we keep the words of metta flowing and even, look inside and see if you can see the feeling of metta, the soft, gentle feeling of loving kindness. It wells up in the heart. With a soft joy. Like the gentle glow around a candle flame. See if you can just notice that feeling and hold it in the mind, keeping it safe. Keeping it close. move into the second stage of metta, keeping the mind just as it is, centered and grounded inside the body. We bring into the name, the words of metta, the name of that loved one. So, for example, if I use my father, may my father be happy. May my father be happy. May my father be happy. Or whoever it is that you've chosen for that second person. May they be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. to the end of the meditation, bring the mind back from loved person to oneself. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Letting the words of metta go, letting the feeling of metta fade away, and allowing the mind to return to a neutral space, empty, open and clear. And with the mind neutral and clear, just take a minute to review over the meditation we've just done together, inquiring into cause and effect. What just happened? How did I use my mind? How did my mind change during the course of that meditation? What was the feeling of metta like? Was there any feeling at all? How long did the feeling last for? And finally, what does my mind feel like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? Before we finish, we can share the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings finally realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Then you can mindfully open your eyes and come out of meditation. Sitting here is a really good place for doing meditation. Halfway through the sitting there, my mind got really bright. I was thinking, wow, it's really good. And I realized it was just the light shining off this. But it was really good anyway. Okay, does anyone have any questions about the metta meditation or any other questions about meditation they'd like to ask? And please, don't feel shy to ask the questions just because you feel like your question's silly. Everybody else has lots of silly questions too. But it helps everybody if you can ask the questions. Yes, please. Well, it's like the difference between white wine and red wine. Metta is like the white wine. Compassion is red wine. It's much richer and more mature. Yeah, it has a different kind of just a different kind of feel to it, because compassion brings in that understanding of suffering. So typically, like with the metta, the words that accompany the metta meditation usually is may I be happy or may all beings be happy. So it's just purely positive. It's that pure just wish for happiness. Whereas compassion, the words they use is may the suffering of all beings be removed, or may I be able to remove or alleviate the suffering of all beings. So it involves an understanding of suffering. Yeah? So that's why compassion actually is a more profound emotion. It's more mature and more profound. But it's also one which is a little bit more delicate, because if you don't have a strong centeredness, yeah, then it's actually quite easy to get caught up in the suffering and the suffering of others, and it can lead to despair or depression and these kinds of things. That's why I think for most people, when they're starting out, doing metta is much safer, is much better. You do find that with people, for example, people who have a lot of compassion sometimes and do a lot of work to help others, and they really feel a strong feeling for the suffering of others, they can very easily get burnt out by it. Yeah, and so you need that strong sense of inner groundedness and go along with it. Yeah. Yes. Well, just because you don't have a self, it doesn't mean you can't love yourself. No, really, it's not something to make a problem out of. Actually, it's just different levels of the teaching. And the idea of not self is, if you think of the teaching in terms of the threefold training, is sila, samadhi, panya, ethics, concentration or meditation, and wisdom. What we're talking about here is at the level of concentration, the level of samadhi, and the idea of not self is at the level of wisdom. Yeah? So we don't have to worry about those questions at the moment. Yeah, you just do the meditation and just take the notion of self as a given, as just in the ordinary way that we think about it every day. Then when it comes time to do vipassana meditation, yeah, and we develop the insight, we can investigate an inquiry, we say, well, what is that self that I'm assuming there? And then at that point, that will be able to let that go. Yeah? And actually, one of the paradoxes of meditation and spiritual practice is that actually the notion of all beings, yeah, is very, very close to the notion of no beings at all. Yeah? So in metta we say, may all beings be happy. Actually, what's happened is that we've already, through doing metta meditation, is we're actually gradually dissolving the boundaries around our self, what we conventionally take to be a self, gradually being dissolved. It's being extended outwards. Yeah, actually, I mean, this is part of an ordinary psychological and emotional development anyway, isn't it? Yeah, that we normally, we extend our sense of identity, for example, to our family or friends or something like that. So we do that to some degree anyway. But in metta meditation, that's taken even further, even deeper. And we really do start to dissolve the boundaries of what our self is. And the difference between self and other gradually becomes obliterated until you have that notion of loving kindness for all beings. And from there, actually to turn to understanding of not self is actually just a very, very slight shift. It's just a slight shift in perspective. And then you see actually what I thought was taking to be all beings, actually is nothing there at all. Yeah. Awfulization, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yes. Yeah, well, I think it is certainly it's a big problem, you know. And I saw it very clearly once when I was in Sydney a few years ago, and it was just a local newspaper, and it had a a headline, and I can't remember the details, but it was like break-ins increase, right? It's new crime statistics for the area, increase in the number of break-ins in homes. And then you read down the article, and the article was contained the latest figures from the local police about the rates of crime for different kinds of crime. And what they were actually saying was that every kind of crime had actually decreased in the area, and only that one kind had increased. So that became the headline. So you just read the headline and you think, oh dear, everything's getting worse. In fact, what it's saying is the exact opposite. So yes, this is I think it's very true, and this is a kind of matter of perception. And of course, the simple reality is that bad news sells, doesn't it? Yeah, and you see that very much in the case of religion, that everyone's very, you know, loves to print news about the latest religious scandal. You know, you've got a naughty priest or something like this, and everyone's all about it. But meanwhile, there's 100 or 1,000 other religious people who are just quietly going about their work and serving the poor and helping people, and nobody seems to think that's worthy of the news. So I think we have to be aware of that and not pay too much attention to it, especially with the media and also with our own propensity. You know, if we're aware of it, then we can, you know, say, well, this, yes, you know, it's okay to listen to that bad news, but not to take it too seriously and not to give it too big a place in your life. Yeah. I always think a good example is in, you know, when in the West, usually what we do is we get up in the morning, first thing we do is get the paper and sit down and read about all the terrible things that happened in the day. Isn't that silly? Don't you think that's so ridiculous? When I was living as a monk in northeast Thailand, villagers would get up, the first thing they would do would be to cook some rice to come out and give to the monks when they come for alms round. Yeah? So it's the first thing you do is make an offering, yeah? Do something to share, to help others. Now, it seems to me that's a much, much healthier way to live. Yeah? So that doesn't mean you can't read the paper, but just be circumspect. Yeah? Just be careful and be aware that it is spinning the information. So just remember to remind yourself of all the good things that are happening. Yeah. You have to do it consciously. Otherwise, you neglect it. Yeah. You can do that as a perception, like I do it sometimes when I'm, you know, if you're driving around the streets, because I have this kind of funny thing, because I live in a forest monastery. The forest monastery live in, it's very kind of remote, and it's just kind of bush and caves and stuff like that. But I come very frequently to Sydney to teach and other big cities. And a lot of people find it really difficult to adjust, you know, like if you've been on retreat and then you come to the city, it's really hard. But I've been doing it for so many years that I don't even notice it. And you just develop all these tricks of perception. So one of the tricks of perception I do when I come to the city is I just look at all the emptiness around me. So yes, you're just sort of driving down the street and you just look at all the spaces in between the cars. You say, people, oh, it's so busy. No, it's not busy. There's nothing on the road. Yeah? I only see spaces there. It's just perception. I spoke once to a fellow who had been a journal reporter for the ABC. Now, in the late 70s in Australia, if those of you who are around in that time would probably remember, there was a famous series of TV ads. There was a competition between Ford and Holden. And they got, I think the first one, I can't remember which one was first, but the first one they got these witches' hats, and they put them on the road and the car kind of dodging in between the witches' hats. And then the competition decided to go one better, so they put people standing in the road and had the cars dodging in between the people. Do you remember that? Do you remember those ads? It was quite famous at the time. And anyway, this journalist interviewed the driver who had been the one dodging all the people. And he said, how do you do it? How do you make sure that you avoid hitting the people? He says, I don't see them. I don't pay any attention to the people. I just aim for the gaps. Yeah, I just aim straight for the middle, for the space between them. And that's all I see. Yeah. So that's how powerful perception is. Yeah, that we don't. It's our choice what we want to see, what kind of world we create, and we actually live in and create very different environments. I saw a wonderful piece of writing about that recently, about that from the perspective of biology, and a biologist was writing that you know we think of environment as something which is given, right? It's something which is just there, but actually, environment is something which is created and conditioned by whatever is participating in the environment. And it gave the example of if you have in the backyard, if you had a patch of grass and a rock, and you had two birds in the backyard. Right, one bird likes to eat seeds, eat grass seeds. So for that bird, the environment is the grass. Another bird likes to pick up the snails and crack the snails open on the rock. Yeah? So for that bird, the environment is the rock. It doesn't care whether there's grass or not. That's completely irrelevant to it. Yeah? And so for the one who's picking the seeds from the grass, whether there's a rock nearby is completely irrelevant. It's not part of their environment. It's a very, very powerful thing to remember, because that we're actually creating our own environment all the time. We're creating our own context. And once you realize that, you realize that, well, actually, we're under control. We can actually choose these things. We're not being forced to read the bad news in the newspaper. We're not being forced to watch the 6:30 news. Yeah? Yeah? We do it if we want to. Yeah? So if you want to, you can do so. But no one's forcing you to do it. Yeah, another perception exercise that I do sometimes when I'm travelling around in the car is you just, because a lot of the time people get really annoyed when somebody doesn't keep the road rules, like if someone cuts in front of you or they run through an orange light or something like that. So you never notice all of the people that actually are keeping the road rules, do you? Yeah, so this is what I do sometimes, is you rejoice. Ah, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Everybody's driving on the left side of the road. Isn't that wonderful? Yeah? And if you don't think that that's an amazing thing, try go to India. That's where they really do just aim for the space, don't they? Yeah, you find any gap in the road, you just go for that. That's the side that you're driving on. Yeah? Sadhu, sadhu. Everyone's stopping at the red light. Yeah? Everybody's putting on their indicator before they turn. Yeah? And you just kind of notice these things and you realize that actually people don't have to do that, do they? Yeah? These are learned behaviors and they're things that we do out of mutual respect. They're things you do out of respect for the other drivers on the road and so on. And yes, you do it out of fear because you'll get busted if you don't do it. There's a little bit of fear in there as well. But mostly you do it because you recognize it's a good thing to do. Yeah? And actually most people, most of the time, act in that kind of way. Yeah? Most people, most of the time, actually are very, very polite and very respectful and very considerate of others. So it's important to notice that, and not just notice when people break out of it or when they do the wrong thing. Okay, so it's 4:15 now, so time's up. So unless there's any more questions, yeah, go on.